This is Free Speech Radio News. It's Monday, October 24, 2005. From the studios of KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado. Newly declassified records reveal the FBI has been conducting improper domestic spying. The UN is raising concerns about earthquake relief work in Pakistan-administered Kashmir. And a look at Turkey's ascension into the European Union. These stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. At least 20 people are reportedly dead after three massive car bombs exploded outside of the Palestine Hotel in Baghdad today. The hotel is used as a base of operations for numerous foreign journalists. Although there are no fatalities reported inside of the hotel, the building was damaged in the series of explosions. An assassination in a West Bank refugee camp could complicate Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas's efforts to demobilize Palestinian armed groups. Manar Jabreen reports from the West Bank.
Two Palestinian fighters were killed Sunday night when Israeli troops opened fire on a house in the Tul Karim refugee camp. Luay al-Saadi, a leader of Al-Quds Brigades, the armed wing of the Islamic Jihad movement in the West Bank, was killed during the ensuing gun battle. Islamic Jihad has vowed to avenge the killing of al-Saadi. Another Islamic Jihad operative was killed in the attack and dozens of civilians were arrested. During last week's visit to the United States, President Mahmoud Abbas vowed to disarm the resistance groups operating within Palestinian territory. Nasser Juma from the Aqsa Martyrs Brigades, the group that Abbas has promised to disarm, said assassinations do not help truce efforts.
Israel did not commit to any of the agreements. This is driving the country into more security deterioration and more violence and bloodshed, which does not prepare the ground for truce that would advance the diplomatic efforts.
The ongoing Israeli practice of targeted assassinations could pose a serious threat to the efforts of the Palestinian Authority to disarm the resistance and observe them in its security and other departments. For FSRN from imemc.org in Palestine, I am Manar Jabreen.
Police and community leaders in the English town of Birmingham are appealing for calm after a weekend of racially fueled violence between local youths. UK correspondent Helen Kelly has more.
Hostility erupted after residents attended a public meeting on Saturday addressing concerns about an unconfirmed sex attack on a 14-year-old Jamaican girl in a store run by Asian shopkeepers. Shops and pubs were ransacked and cars set on fire during the disorder, which reportedly involved several hundred rioters. A number of petrol bombs were thrown and at least 12 gunshots were reported. Four people were stabbed during the violent clashes, including a man in his 20s who later died from the injuries. A total of 35 people were taken to hospital, with police reporting up to 80 separate criminal incidents. The rioting continued into Sunday when police and youths were involved in a standoff, during which time a local mosque was attacked. An 18-year-old man has died in hospital after he was shot close to that scene. While order has now been returned to Birmingham, fears of further clashes remain in one of the city's most ethnically diverse areas, which was similarly scarred some 20 years ago during the 1985 Handsworth riot, sparked by the arrest of a black man after a police stop and search. Helen Kelly, reporting from London for Free Speech Radio News.
Brazilians went to the polls yesterday to vote in the first referendum in the country's history. In Sao Paulo, Natalia Viana has the details.
The results of the referendum were very disappointing for those engaged in the campaign to reduce the number of guns within national territory. 63.5% of the Brazilian voters decided against a ban on the sale of firearms and ammunition. The referendum was part of an important legislative package approved by Congress in December 2003. Since then, it has been illegal for anyone except private security, police and the armed forces to carry a firearm. The sale of guns will still be allowed, although with a stricter set of criteria. Manufacturers are also now obliged to print a code in every weapon and each bullet in order to make it easier to track its origin in case of a crime. According to official figures, in 2003, firearms caused 108 deaths per day, about 40,000 per year. That represents 63% of all the homicides committed in Brazil. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Natalia Viana in São Paulo, Brazil.
Residents of Cancun are surveying the destruction wrought by Hurricane Wilma. The storm cut a quick path over Florida this morning and has shot out into the Atlantic Ocean. From WMNF in Tampa, Andrew Stelzer has more.
Mexican troops and federal police moved into downtown Cancun today. They've set up checkpoints to search people for what they say are stolen goods. As in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, some people are entering deserted stores for survival needs, while others are stealing furniture and appliances. Four people were killed by Wilma in Mexico, and thousands of homes have been destroyed in Cancun and the island of Cozumel. Many tourists are as of yet unaccounted for, and the Marriott has announced the closure of their resorts through the end of the year. More than 3 million people in Florida lost power because of the storm, which crossed the state early this morning. There are early reports of roofs being torn off, and one death has been reported. In Key West, the streets are flooded, and many residents decided against evacuating, despite orders to do so by officials. For FSRN, from WMNF in Tampa, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
Newly declassified documents indicate there were over 150 violations by the FBI in surveillance activities in 2003, which were connected to the Patriot Act. This comes after Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez testified to Congress that there were no violations connected to the expanded powers, and just before Congress is to put its final touches on the Patriot Reauthorization Bill. Mitch Jezerich reports from Washington.
Between year 2002 and 2004, there have been at least 13 cases in which the FBI's Office of General Counsel has investigated FBI misconduct of surveillance on people in the country. Within these cases, it appears that there were at least 153 violations of surveillance activities in year 2003 alone. This information comes from a lawsuit by the Electronic Privacy Information Center, a government watchdog group in Washington, D.C., who released the FBI documents today. Marsha Hoffman is with the group, also known by its acronym, EPIC.
These 13 complaints, which apparently have been identified by the FBI as relating to sunsetting provisions of the Patriot Act, involve a number of different scenarios. Some of them are situations where agents have not complied with the reporting requirements that that they are required to observe. There was one situation where an agent collected financial records, apparently from a bank, without going through the proper channels to do that. There's also a situation where an intelligence agency that is not the FBI conducted some sort of an unconsented physical search that it didn't have the authority to conduct.
The documents also show that the FBI conducted surveillance on some U.S. residents for at least 18 months at a time without proper consent. The FBI also surveyed emails with an expired warrant. The records contradict what Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez testified to Congress last spring when he said he knew of no violations under the Patriot Act. Congress is set to vote on a final bill to reauthorize the Patriot Act within the next couple of weeks, and it appears the final product will make most of the controversial 16 provisions permanent that are set to expire by the end of the year. Hoffman says she tried to get the documents beforehand so that information could be a part of the debate, but she says she was stalled along the way.
I made the request for these documents back in March, and we had hoped to receive some information from the FBI shortly thereafter. We ended up filing a lawsuit to obtain the information, and we have just only recently gotten this first set of documents. And while we should be getting more, this certainly does come at the end of Congress's consideration of whether to renew or not.
Supporters of the Patriot Act would likely claim that these newly declassified documents show that the FBI was addressing the violations that occurred, and thus the system works. To that, Hoffman agrees, but
the question remains whether Congress knew about these situations at all. The Intelligence Oversight Board is not required to report things like this to Congress. It reports them to the President and also to the Attorney General. So it's interesting to note that the Attorney General testified before Congress this spring that he was unaware of a single substantiated allegation of a civil liberties abuse involving the Patriot Act. I think here we've found a number that the FBI has internally identified as potential intelligence abuses involving the Patriot Act.
The documents obtained by EPIC were heavily redacted, so it's difficult to know the nature of most of the violations. More documents are still expected to be handed over by the FBI. According to published reports, the FBI says that none of the cases involved major violations and that most can be attributed to administrative errors. Mitch Jezerich, Free Speech Radio News.
President Bush said today that the investigation into the outing of an undercover CIA operative was very serious. This comes as the special prosecutor, Patrick Fitzgerald, appears to be close to indicting two top White House officials, Karl Rove and Scooter Libby, in the case. Some Republican senators have begun saying that Fitzgerald may be overzealous in the case, and they say possible perjury charges would be little more than legal technicalities. Democratic Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois made this statement from the Senate floor.
And to minimize the possibility of someone being indicted for perjury overlooks the obvious. What is at stake here? What is at issue here in this investigation involving Valerie Plame is the fact that this woman was a career employee of the Central Intelligence Agency in a covert status, which meant people didn't know what she was doing. And that gave her entree and opportunity that others didn't have. So protecting her identity was an important part of her service to this nation. There are many just like her who risk their lives every day for America to make it safer to uncover potential acts of terrorism before they occur. And so when her husband, a former ambassador, put an article in the newspaper critical of the Bush administration for overstating the reasons we were going to invade Iraq, someone, according to columnist Robert Novak, two people in the White House came forward to out her identity. They did that for the most venal political reasons, to punish her and her husband for speaking out against the administration. Now that is a crime, to out the identity of a CIA agent. Who created this crime? It was a crime created by President Bush's father, who former head of the CIA, who was so enraged that if someone had written a book disclosing the identity of a CIA agent which he believed resulted in their death, that he called on Congress to pass a law to say that if anybody disclosed that identity, they should be held responsible for it. That's what's at the heart of this.
Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois commenting today on the floor of the Senate regarding the investigation into the outing of an undercover CIA operative. In other news from the Capitol,
I will do everything in my power in collaboration with my Fed colleagues to help to ensure the continued prosperity and stability of the American economy.
Ben Bernanke, a former member of the Fed board and current chairman of the President's Council of Economic Advisers, has been nominated to succeed Federal Reserve Board Chairman Alan Greenspan. Some analysts say Bernanke might be more tolerant of choices that could allow consumer prices to rise. Although in his comments to the press earlier today, Bernanke said he would not venture far from the current standards.
If I am confirmed to this position, my first priority will be to maintain continuity with the policies and policy strategies established during the Greenspan years.
Alan Greenspan's term as Federal Reserve Chairman is set to end in late January. United Nations officials are raising serious concern about the relief work in the quake-devastated parts of Pakistan and Pakistan-administered Kashmir. Kofi Annan talked last week about the risk of a second wave of deaths as winter approaches. UN Humanitarian Aid Area Coordinator Rashid Khalikov in Muzaffarabad on Sunday said the world did not clearly comprehend the magnitude and complexity of the disaster in its first days and that it was just now coming to grips with the catastrophe. UN officials have called the relief operation in Pakistan and Kashmir one of the toughest in the world. Meanwhile, traditional rivals India and Pakistan are talking about proposals to open the line of control in divided Kashmir. FSRN's Shahnawaz Khan has more.
2 weeks after a strong earthquake rocked South Asia, devastating many parts of Kashmir and Pakistan, aid workers are still struggling to reach to all the affected people in the region. On Sunday, UN Humanitarian Aid Coordinator in Pakistan-administered Kashmir, Rashid Khalikov, said thousands of people still need to be reached in high-altitude terrain. Earlier, another top UN relief coordinator appealed to NATO and other potential donors to step in with a second Berlin Air Bridge of helicopters flying in relief supplies and evacuating perhaps hundreds of thousands of people. Secretary General Kofi Annan has also called for a greater world response to the quake in Pakistan, also requesting to contribute helicopters, trucks, and heavy lifting equipment. With around 3 million homeless people in need of winterized tents, the UN's Khalikov said all the tents available in the world are being eyed for this relief operation. In response, India and Pakistan are scheduled to begin discussions on Saturday to open the line of control in Kashmir. The heavily militarized line of control divides Kashmir into portions administered by India and Pakistan, both of whom claim Kashmir in full. The line has been one of the hurdles in the relief operations, hindering Kashmiris on the two sides to interact and help each other. Nawtej Sarna is the spokesman for the External Affairs Ministry in India.
The government has decided to set up three composite relief centers and rehabilitation points along the line of control. These centers are at Kaman near Aman Setu, Titwal, and Chikandabagh in Poonch. These centers are to provide facilities for medical assistance and relief to people affected by the earthquake from across the line of control.
But it is easier said than done. Sensitive about their security concerns, India and Pakistan are still to finalize the modalities for opening the line of control. Pakistan says it has taken up a composite proposal about movement of Kashmiri relief workers, victims and their relatives along the line of control. Tasneem Aslam is the foreign ministry spokesman in Pakistan.
It's a comprehensive proposal about facilitating the two-way movement of Kashmiris across the line of control. We have also proposed that the delegations, working level delegations headed by senior officials of the respective foreign offices should meet this month, within this month, to finalize the arrangements and for implementation at the earliest.
India's proposal to open relief points on its side did not impress many in Kashmir, where people thought it was not enough. Arif Ahmed is a businessman in Srinagar.
The need of the hour was to open the entire LOC because thousands and thousands of people have suffered across the line of control. And Kashmir as a whole is one area with one kind of people, one kind of atmosphere.
Scores of villages in hilly terrain along the line of control are inaccessible since the quake. A military barrier in the form of line of control is another hurdle for rescuers and aid workers. Kashmiri leaders like Yasin Malik of the Jammu and Kashmir Liberation Front also called India's proposal insignificant. Currently in Pakistan, visiting the quake-devastated areas, Malik said the quake victims were not in a position to travel to the relief points along the Indian side of LOC. He asked India to allow aid workers cross the line of control to help with relief work in Pakistan-administered Kashmir. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Shahnawaz Khan from Srinagar, Kashmir.
Turkey has officially begun accession talks with the European Union, a process which will take a decade to complete. Austria, and now Germany's new chancellor, would prefer to see Turkey as a privileged partner instead of gaining full membership. But many believe that this is already the case, while Turkey's prime minister has made it clear that the only way forward now is full EU membership. Since 1999, when full EU membership was first touted as a possibility, human rights have significantly improved within Turkey. But international human rights organizations note that there are still problems. Sinema Nepard reports from Berlin.
Geographically, Turkey is a bridge between Europe and the Middle East, and culturally, it's the first predominantly Islamic nation to be considered for EU membership. Despite being a mostly poor nation, Turkey's economy has been growing steadily, especially over the past 3 years. Internally, Turkey has a problematic human rights record regarding its treatment of the Kurdish population, Armenian genocide, torture in police custody, and curbing of freedom of speech and civil liberties. Although some believe the EU requirements could have been tougher in this area, Özcan Mutlu, State Greens MP in Berlin, has already seen significant improvement with open discussion about the Armenian genocide in Turkey. But the biggest challenge remains with recognition of the Kurdish language and culture, which was previously forbidden.
From my last visit in Turkey, I was in Antalya to this famous Turkish film festival, the Golden Orange Film Festival, and I was surprised. All of a sudden, there was a young Kurdish singer on the stage and she sang in Kurdish. The governor was there, the mayor was there, and the minister for culture and tourism was there, and a crowd of 20,000 people listening to this Kurdish young lady. 3 or 4 years ago, she would be in jail for that. No one would give her a chance to go to the stage. But now she was there and it was wonderful. And I also witnessed in some courthouses people speaking Kurdish translated to Turkish so the judge can understand. This is also something you couldn't imagine just 3 years ago. It would be something incredible. But it is happening nowadays.
Although accession into the EU has a way to go, one resident of Istanbul speaking for German public radio has high hopes of the positive change EU membership will bring.
If Turkey becomes a member of the European Union, the individual rights, the democratic rights, the human rights will be daily valid reality of this country.
Another outstanding issue is Turkey refusing to acknowledge the Greek Cypriot government. But Berlin Greens MP Özcan Mutlu believes these reforms will happen over time. Still, the road to EU accession will not be an easy path. Barbara Lippert, Deputy Director of the Institute of European Politics, or the IEP in Berlin, points out that Turkey can't just slot into the existing system.
In terms of consistency, of policies, Turkey is a class of its own and cannot be compared to previous states acceding to the EU. Maybe you could draw a parallel to Great Britain, which is also a country at the periphery with very strong, let's say, intergovernmental instincts and a policy agenda of its own. So it will be very difficult also when it comes to the contents of policies to really absorb Turkey and integrate Turkey into the EU.
For now, negotiations between Turkey and the EU have begun in earnest, with an interesting road expected over the next decade. For Free Speech Radio News in Berlin, I'm Cinnamon Nippard.
As many as 1,000 undocumented immigrants are currently working in New Orleans, according to aid workers in the city. The immigrant workers are usually paid far below the prevailing wage, not paid overtime, and are sometimes denied medical care and even food and water. FSRN's Christian Roseland reports from New Orleans, where he spoke with immigrant workers.
Mexico.
Tamaulipas.
De Mexico. De
Matamoros,
Tamaulipas.
Though the license plates of the company vehicles say Texas and Florida, a brief conversation with these construction workers in New Orleans reveals that they have come from much farther away. The three men are putting tarps on damaged roofs as part of FEMA's Blue Roof program, in which certain homes are given free emergency repairs paid for by the federal agency. They have been working 6 and 7 days a week, often as much as 12 or 14 hours a day. One of the laborers, who declined to give his name, had traveled far to be here and was concerned about a delay in pay.
I've been here a month in New Orleans. Right now I'm being treated well. I don't have a problem with anything. Only one thing, the pay is a little late. Already it's a week and no one has been paid. Oh, yeah, I like it. Because we were in a situation where we were looking for work, and that's why we're here.
Both the working conditions and the origin of these workers is far from unusual in New Orleans these days.
There are about 1,000 undocumented immigrants working in the city of New Orleans right now.
Aid worker Maria Hernandez, a volunteer with Food Not Bombs, has been meeting undocumented workers since she arrived in the city a month ago. She says that last Thursday's discovery of 13 undocumented immigrants at a Halliburton subsidiary work site is a very small fraction of the total. Hernandez says that these immigrants are living and working in conditions where basic needs are not being met.
Some of them are being just put in a campground, you know, or any backyard to stay there. Then they're not given any food or any water, and then the pay for 12, 14 hours a day, it's very low. The lowest I've heard is $5 an hour, and they've never told me about overtime. You know, they just said that's the flat rate that they're getting pretty much.
Ultimately, Maria points out that it is important not to blame the immigrants for this situation.
The immigrants here are not enemies. These are people that are coming to this country because they need the money, you know, and they're funding a great opportunity here. So it's not really their fault. The problem is that these people are being taken advantage of.
Reading for Christian Roseland, who's in New Orleans, this is Eric Klein for Free Speech Radio News.
A report released by the U.S. Justice Department over the weekend reveals that the prison population in California and around the country continues to increase. Grace Turner reports.
After all, the purpose of a democracy is to make sure everybody participates in the process.
George Bush, speaking on the White House lawn, congratulates Iraqis on their recent elections. Just 1 week later, the U.S. Justice Department releases a report confirming that our democratic government still holds the dubious title of number one incarcerator in the world. The report states that at the end of last year, the number of inmates in federal, state, local, and other prisons totaled nearly 2.3 million people. A shocking figure considering China, the second highest incarcerator, has four times more citizens, yet half as many prisoners.
The U.S. prison system continues to expand at dangerously incremental rates, and the prisons are filling up with poor people of color.
Judy Greenspan is a board member of California Prison Focus, a statewide organization dedicated to protecting the rights of prisoners. African Americans, as just 13% of the U.S. population, are overrepresented in prisons, topping 41% of U.S. inmates. Despite a decrease in the amount of violent crime over the past 10 years, federal incarceration facilities are now 40% over capacity. Texas operates the largest state prison system with 168,000 inmates, followed closely by California.
It's a tremendous travesty and something that enrages anyone, or should enrage anyone, who is really for the human rights of all people. Prisoners have human rights. They deserve human rights. Poor people do not deserve to be locked up in prison because, you know, they can't make it in this totally, you know, dog-eat-dog, the rich, only the rich survive type of system.
Greenspan says law enforcement officials unfairly target low-income individuals and people of color. Members of California Prison Focus are encouraging people to push for alternatives to incarceration, like community rehabilitation centers and drug treatment facilities.
The main crime that people are being picked up for, the scapegoat, the reason, is drug addiction. And it's something that should not be a crime. It's certainly a medical condition, and there are ways to treat it. There are many corporations in this country who make billions of dollars on the prison industrial complex. Some of the same companies that are making billions of dollars within the war in Iraq. So until we can really wrest control of the system from them, the prison system will continue to expand. Or until we can build a movement that is formidable enough to stand up to the likes of all of these multi-billion dollar companies.
10 states reported population increases of at least 5% during 2004, including Minnesota, Idaho, and Georgia. Alabama, Rhode Island, and New York were among the 11 states that saw a decrease. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Grace Turner.
Free Speech Radio News is a worker-owned collective produced at KPFA in Berkeley and KPFK in Los Angeles. Our newscast is produced by Simba Russo and Monica Lopez. Mitch Jezerich is our Washington editor. Headlines editor is Shannon Young. Technical production by Eric Klein and Jade Paget-Seekins. In Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.